Thank you, Judith. I guess everyone's pretty pleased that you can finally turn off the air conditioning and look for those sweaters that have been pushed back somewhere. Well, thank you for your invitation. It's good to be here. What I hope to do over the next few minutes is to share, the centerpiece of what I would like to share with you today is a conversation that I had online with a young man who lives in Canada and who's part of the community where I went to grad school, and I actually am an adjunct professor there. So I frequent St. Stephen, New Brunswick. In fact, I leave this coming Tuesday for a lecture series there. And so what I want to share with you is a conversation that we had that took place over several days. He was inquiring about race in America as a Canadian, but a particular kind of Canadian. Where I teach it's a Christian liberal arts university, but their thinking tends to be pretty progressive. And he didn't go to school there. He was not a part of that community, but he married someone from that community. So he has long been, he's in his late 20s now, but he emerged from a very conservative environment, and he married into not just a wife who is liberal, but to a community that is liberal, and he relocated there, and so he has been a challenge to them, and they've been a challenge to him, and so that's where this conversation begins. And the moment that the conversation starts is, you'll remember that in July, the first week, July 8th, actually, I think it was maybe July 7th, that a black man, a veteran, procured some high-powered weapons in Dallas and started killing police officers. So this was kind of the impetus for him to start writing me. And we'll get to that in just a moment. But I thought it might be better if I share a little bit of a personal introduction. Is that, you think that would be, since you don't know me? So I'll start by saying that our family, my parents and my siblings, live in California, and we are an exception. Not many of my relatives are Californians. Our family started as slaves. My great 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 grandmother was a slave. She was raped by her master, and that was the beginning of our family. So, as pretty much all African Americans, we have white blood in us. Our family, his name was Spalding. She took his name. You'll say, well, my name's not Spalding, but the two branches, two families came together very early on. And today, documented by the Los Angeles Times, the Spalding-Moore family reunion is the largest family reunion, regularly meeting family reunion in the United States. My family's ground zero is North Carolina. I have a lot of family who were who became professionals even in the 19th century, but the vast majority of them were manual laborers, many sharecroppers in the tobacco industry. And both of my parents were born, my dad in Fayetteville, my mom in North Carolina. My dad tells me that the reason that he moved away from North Carolina, and eventually his siblings, most of them did, not all of them, But the reason is because he did not want his kids to grow up in that very hostile environment racially. I'll give you an example. One of my dad's nephews, one of my cousins, older than me, when my dad was 17, my dad's older brother asked my dad to pick up his son, my dad's nephew, from school one day. Well, my dad was 17, he was a bus rider, and so he went and picked up his nephew, and they boarded the bus together, and as they were riding the bus, they were asked to step off by the driver, and two men came to where they were standing after they got off the bus and asked my dad what he was doing with the boy. And the reason is that my cousin looks very white, and so he was wondering what a black boy was doing with a little white boy. My dad knew instantly that this could be the end of his life, because he had the experience of seeing a black man charred hanging from a tree before. So my dad decided that, you know, we're going to, one day I'm not going to live here. And so he and mom married in 1953. So my parents have been married for 62 years. But when they got married, the same week that they married, they boarded a train westward. And as they sat in the train, the porter came. They were the only two black people on the train. The porter came and drew a curtain between them and the rest of the passengers. But my dad said it didn't bother them because they were crazy in love anyway. So. So we moved here, so we were separated from family. When I was 2 years old, and, you know, some of you know this, that some people remember their twos. When I was 2 years old, my dad, my mom, myself, and my infant sister were on our way to North Carolina to visit family. And on our way there, this was during the Jim Crow period still. So this is during a period where they could not get a motel room. They didn't even try. So, I mean, they didn't plan to. They planned to alternate as drivers. Well, mom fell asleep, totaled the car, and I have the visual image of the car, of being pulled out of the car by my dad, whose face was covered in blood, being pulled out of the upside-down car, and the image of the wheels spinning, and then later sitting on the side of the road with my mom praying. An ambulance, I can remember, I still have the sensation of, you know, being a little boy, but lying down in the ambulance. But because this was during the era when hospitals were segregated, the ambulance did not take us to a hospital. Took our family to a black-owned funeral home. And my dad said the best part of the story was that the woman didn't charge us for the two nights that we stayed there. So that's a little bit about the Moore family and why we are Californians. Anybody who's been around African Americans will resonate. You will know that you have heard often the saying, "The struggle is real." Anybody here ever heard that? All right, that's a big thing. The struggle is real, and the reason that we keep telling ourselves the struggle is real is because we live in a society that tells us that it's in our minds. In order for us to maintain our own sanity, we have to remind each other that this is a real thing that's happening. And so before I go into that conversation, I would like to share with you the poetry of Sonny Patterson. And you have the printout, but what I'm going to do here is let her share her poem with us, so you can you can whether you want look at the note, her words. or you can read them later. But let's I should tell you, when she was out at UCSB last week, in fact, but she wrote this in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. She is from New Orleans. And so this is, it captures the pathos of her experience in New Orleans. So let's see, I think we can just pull this up and it should work.
And we know this place. Yes. Well, we have glanced more times than we'd like to share into eyes that stare with nothing there behind them but an unfulfilled wish and an unconscious yearning for life, though death rests comfortably beside us at night, their moans are louder. They come to visit the guards at the gate and they stay until morning, torturing their guilt written inside. The silent cries of the keepers are louder than the booms that come from the guns they use to occupy the space, and we know this place. So we have seen more times than we'd like to imagine, bloated cadavers, floating through the waters of a city gone savage, foraging the land for what can be salvaged, but what can be saved when all is lost. It happens in August, 29 days in. We are now 5 days out of the only place we knew to call house and home. Two things are certain. One, we have no food. Two, there are more bodies lying at the roadside than hot plates being distributed, or first aid being administered, or recognition as a citizen, 14th Amendment, check, refugee, check, and we know this place. Ever changing, yet forever the same. Money and power and greed, the game they suck and devour the souls of the slain. What a feast for the beast at their table of shame, with napkins round necks to catch the blood that drains from the flesh they chew. It's hell to gain, and we know this place all too well. Dank with the smell of death and doom, it hovers, it smothers. No growth, no room, no pretty, no please, just gray, just gloom, just bored me a hope, and it died too soon. Just jumping, just jiving, just living, just fools. And we know this place. Death in all its array and splendor. Golden streets with good intentions capture our attention. Gadgets and inventions, pesticide food supplies, flu-like symptoms, diabetic condition, a cancer in the system, health on hold. It's a pistol to the temple, one to the churches, tell wellness simple. Good works and good deeds is what equals redemption. Tell me, please, Jesus never mentioned. How do churchmen get extensions on freedom while children are being fondled from the altar to the street, then back to the sanctuary? It's kind of scary, ain't it, to know that both the prophet and the priest practice deceit, then come to the people and claim peace, peace. They come to the people and claim love, love. Where is the peace? But where is the love? Where is that balm in Gilead that can heal the wounded soul or make the half man? And oh, I swear, we know this place. We have vowed before never again to return, but here we are. Death in the desert. Dry mouth and thirsting for water from heaven, but come, come, children. Rally around, and maybe together we can make a sound that'll shake the trees or rattle the ground, make strong our knees. We the freedom bound, and we know this place. Reclaim the crown, hold on to the prize, never put it down. Be firm in the stance, no break, no bow. Gotta forward on, mama, make your move now. Forward on, Baba, make the move now. Forward, dear children, for freedom is now. Hey!
I think that was Sunny's way of saying, of affirming that the struggle is real. We know this place. We've been here. We're acquainted. This is not new. And yet, freedom is now, which seems antithetical. But the thing is that we learn how to create mental freedom in the midst of oppression and imprisonment of various types. The struggle is real, and this is what I was seeking to communicate in so many words in this conversation, where this young man, 26 years old, who's a part of that community in Canada that I was talking about, he writes me the day after the shootings of those policemen in Dallas. "Hello, Mr. Moore. How are you doing? It's been a rough week for race relations in the States, hasn't it? I'm writing this message because you have a valuable perspective that I'm missing in my life here in rural New Brunswick. I have many black friends from Kenya, but they are all my age, and as you know, they have a whole different set of problems they face every day over there. I would like to get your perspective on racism in America, if you have the time to answer, because you are one of the few black men I know from the U.S. who's older than me. My main question is this: how much change have you seen in the racial climate from when you were a little boy till today?" And I have to tell you, there was a cross current here, because my daughter and my son-in-law live in Japan. My daughter had been having another conversation with me, and in her conversation, she was saying, "Dad, I don't think things are any different from when you were a kid, or from when Granddad was a kid." And so I would, proffer some dad's experience, I said, "But you never seen a charred man hanging from a tree." She says, "Yes, but I saw Philando Castile get shot by a policeman in his car." And so she had a rejoinder for everything that I was saying. And then finally, I think she kind of, I don't know if I won, if that matters, but finally I told her, I said, "I have to believe that things are better, because if things are not better, that means that a lot of noble people did their labor for nothing. Whether it's Sojourner Truth, Harriet Tubman, Frederick Douglass, Nat Turner, who's in the public eye right now, all the way to W.E. Du Bois and Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and so on and so on." And I said that then does that mean that they wasted their time? I have to believe that they made a difference. So here's my reply to Stephen. I hate to say there's no progress, Stephen, because that would mean that some very noble people sacrificed for nothing. I have intense conversations with my daughter, who seems to be sure that life as an African American is the same as for her grandparents, and that conditions have only morphed. If I tell her that she never saw a burned corpse hanging from a tree like Dad did, she points out a number of things that could be the equivalent. She has a rejoinder for everything, as argued in Michelle Alexander's landmark work, The New Jim Crow. My daughter and I communicated yesterday, and I noted that because Jews are being persecuted in Europe, it does not negate the uniqueness of the Holocaust. So, in short, I am not sure, Stephen. Stephen, thanks for your quick reply. I know you're a busy man. I guess I should read The New Jim Crow, as this is the second or third time I've heard it mentioned as an important resource. Your conversations with your daughter about race are very interesting to me, because I feel that's where the majority of my struggling to fully embrace the Black Lives Matter movement comes from. When I look around, I don't see the systemic and institutionalized racism that's talked about. I see black people thriving in the States. There's a black president, black Supreme Court justice, black sheriffs, black judges. I, as an admitted outsider, don't see the structural racism. I see affirmative action and a government that does more than any other government on the planet to help their minority communities. When I look at the stats on police killings, I find that there have been hundreds and hundreds of more white people killed by police in the last decade than black people. I even read a stat that said a white male involved in an active criminal lifestyle was more likely to be killed by police than his black counterpart. I heard on the radio today that police are 18.5 times more likely to be killed by a black male than a black male is to be killed by the police, even though black males only make up 6% of the population. So I just have all these contradictions flying around in my mind about this stuff. And then the biggest problem is I don't feel I can discount your or any other African American's personal experience or attitudes about their situation. I would hate if I was experiencing a hardship and some outsider came along and said, "No, you're not." But on the other hand, I know we live in a broken and twisted world where people have all kinds of ideas and beliefs that aren't based in reality. I have a lot of reflection to do and would appreciate any other thoughts or perspective you could share. I know you probably have a ton of demands on your time and that schooling a white kid from Canada about racism is not at the top of your priority list. I spent a long time in Kenya as a youth and my parents were missionaries there. I have a little sister who we adopted from Kenya, which is why it's crucial to me that I don't get on the wrong side of this debate. My reply. Stephen, because, you know, I got to respond to all of that. Stephen, I have had friends who found freedom of thought and enjoyed their capacity to become more judicious and compassionate after they weaned themselves from exposure to information as presented by right-wing news, whose intent is to get people to imagine that others are damaging their otherwise wonderful world. They have a lot to protect by appealing to nativism and the good old days. They want to make America great again, fairy tale for some and a horror story for others. And so I attached a link to him to an article by someone involved, very involved in Black Lives Matter, and a pretty edgy article that traces the police forces in America to slave patrols. So here's his reply after I sent him that. I don't see the truth in this article, Dr. Moore. The police in America are just an evolved version of the slave patrol? That's false. Every functioning nation in the entire world needs a police force. I used to think we didn't need police when I was a young anarchist punk rocker, but then I realized that police are the only thing that keeps evil people from running wild in society. What I got from this article is that the government created those issues, that they don't have the ability to solve them. Where is the accountability for the rampant violence in majority black communities? Police killings account for 4% of the murders of black people, but they account for over 12% of the murders of white and Hispanic people. What are the police supposed to do about the other 96% of the murders in your community, especially when Black Lives Matter won't even publicly acknowledge that there's a bigger problem of black-on-black crime going on here? I've listened to hip-hop for years, and I've watched tons of documentaries about gangs and life in the ghetto. I don't think you can honestly deny that black youths are killing one another every single day, and it's a massive problem. So why do we only hear about this one part of the overall problem? All I hear from Black Lives Matter is how all the problems of the black community in America are because of my skin color, my people, and my heritage. Where is the accountability on your side for the bigger issues? Blaming systemic racism for everything just seems ineffective and doesn't give me any hope that things are going to change. Last weekend, for example, 4 little black children were shot in drive-by shootings. Where is the outrage and protesting for these innocents? It feels like when something doesn't fit the narrative that Black Lives Matter is trying to tell America, they don't talk about it. And he sends me a video. This video, he says, holds a lot of hope in it, I feel. His answer feels true to me on a gospel level. Well, the video that he sent me was an interview, a relatively recent interview, of an evangelical pastor. Maybe you've heard of John MacArthur. Anybody? All right. He's been on radio for 3 decades, syndicated Christian radio, a very prominent voice in that community. In this video, John MacArthur talks about how when he was young, he marched with Dr. King, and he even eulogized some African-Americans who had been killed in the movement. And he said, but he's come to a place in his life as a Christian and as a pastor and as a theologian where he feels like all of our solutions are contained in the message of the gospel of Jesus suffering, dying, being buried and raised from the dead. And he says, if we only come to this message, we'll solve every problem. And so, you know, I listened to his conclusions in this video, and this is my reply to Stephen after watching the video. Stephen, I kept having to step over the Calvinism in order to keep listening. I was waiting to hear how the gospel empowers us to bring change. I listened to the end. It was odd to hear MacArthur celebrate King for doing what MacArthur refuses to do. This is Stephen's reply. I guess I've never really considered Calvinism to be a problem. I'll need to think about that now. I think you have a fair point that MacArthur may be taking a far too hands-off approach. I just love the notion that the power of the gospel transcends all these issues, and that the power of Christ's love can change our hearts about this stuff so radically that we can truly stop seeing color of skin and start seeing brothers and sisters in Christ. My words to him. Calvin has redeeming qualities, but MacArthur is too exclusive. Think of it this way. Martin Luther King died for his convictions, but Calvin killed for his. You are not alone in considering Calvinism to not be a problem. It continues to be a carrier of genocide. And as far as not seeing color of skin, I dealt with that last Sunday, so I sent him a link to my Sunday sermon. And in this sermon, what I do is we were on the verge of the Olympic Games, and I talked about how nations are different from countries. Like Ethiopia and Eritrea have the same nations, but they're separate countries. But then you go to somewhere like Iraq, and there are all these nations in a single country. It's a political entity. And Jesus sent his messengers to the nations, not to political states, but to people of various ethnic backgrounds for healing. And so I shared that with him, and I said to him, I appreciate your desire to stretch, and here's what he writes me. I listened to the sermon last night, and I just listened again to make sure it was clear and fresh in my mind, and I jotted down some questions I had. First of all, I have to say I was extremely moved and convicted by the message. I listened in the car last night with my wife, and we both agreed that there was power and truth behind everything you were saying. It really brought it home to me how blessed I am to have a wise and qualified church leader taking the time to answer some of my uncomfortable questions. I really can't thank you enough, and I don't want you to feel you have to answer any further questions quickly or even at all. Probably what I was struck by most was the implications that healing the nations has for my personal identity. If I stop identifying as a Canadian citizen and instead identify by my Caucasian ethnicity, I find myself looking at a monster. We are warriors. We invade. We colonize. We kill. We've never known long periods of peace. Our violence always seeps into our religion and our churches. Like the biologist member of your congregation said, we have a burning need to rule and to hoard and protect our own kin, as humans do. And we've been aggressively successful in manifesting these desires. If I identify as a Canadian, there's still a little of the animalistic warrior complex there for sure, but at least it's not at the top of the values list. At the top, we value things like equality, freedom, and diversity of views, lifestyles, and beliefs. It's a big burden you're asking me to take on if you're asking me to take into my identity the British Empire or the medieval church or even the Roman Empire. I have a few other questions as well, but I think I'd better just end by asking, where do I begin? In my journey ahead of confronting my own nationhood in attempting to learn how to raise up and glorify other nations and to give up my rights as Jesus gave up his rights, what do I need to be doing? How can I help heal the nations, Dr. Moore? My reply, I am moved by your questions, Stephen. They reflect your sincere quest for understanding. And then I send him another link to a sermon. I said, last week's talk was the first of a three-part series. It could be that some of your questions will be partially answered if you listen to the next part. And then I concluded by saying I'm interested in how you answer those questions for yourself. Firstly, because I do think it's important for you to embrace your European tribes and your religion as well. So that's just that's a portion. The conversation keeps it comes back. Started in July. We keep talking. So this is in a moment I want to lead, and I'm almost done, but I want to lead into Stephen Dynan. But I want to just point out that when I was in Ferguson, and I'm going there again next month. When I was in Ferguson last November, I had something of a tour guide, a young man in his late 20s, involved in Black Lives Matter. His name is Tory Russell. I was really impressed with his knowledge, his grasp of what had happened. We started out at the market where Michael Brown stole the cigarillos. And we walked together. It's a 30-minute walk. We walked together to the place where Michael Brown's corpse lay in the street for 4.5 hours. And he gave me the play-by-play where the National Guard was, how this building got burned down, that kind of thing. And at the end, where we were talking kind of going on a few rabbit trails, Tory told me, he said, we were talking about sports, and he said, well, as an athlete and as a child growing up desiring to be an athlete, there were only 4 people in the athletic world that I looked up to. And I asked him who they were, and he said, number 1, Jim Brown. Number 2, Muhammad Ali. Number 3, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. And number 4, and he coupled Tommy Smith and John Carlos of 68 Olympics fame for holding their fists up during the anthem ceremony. He said, because they're the only ones who are into more than their own advantage. They gave up things. They gave up prestige. They gave up finance in order to be leaders in the African-American community. So then I asked Tory, I asked, do you see anybody out there today? This was a year ago, remember. I said, you see anybody out there today? And Tory said, ain't nobody. But ironically, Tory and I went together that very evening to the University of Missouri, where the students were, the football team was boycotting, demanding the resignation of the president of the university, among other things. And a large contingent of the students had set up a tent city in the heart of campus. And we went around interviewing students. Tory was kind of incredulous that the football team did this, because college football teams do not jeopardize their scholarships like this. But the coach was in their corner, the white coach. And we talked with students there, we asked the students, so what do you think you're going to get out of this? Do you think that these demands are going to be actually met? Is the president going to resign? This was on a Sunday night, and the students were pretty unanimous in saying, no, that's not going to happen. If it does, it'll take forever. You know what happened? The next morning, the president resigned. This is the power of sport, especially in the college world. He resigned, and it was the beginning, but to hear the students talk about their experience was so painful. Like, there's a frat area where they hung out Confederate flags, and what was encouraging was to see how many white families. Here we are, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, and I saw parents with their children coming to bring mittens and lunch, Subway sandwiches and things like that for the students who were striking. But it was discouraging at the level to see how even though they were demonstrating, they didn't really have a lot of hope for change. And then the hope produced change. They accomplished something. Which shows that, sometimes it takes a radical demonstration to bring about change. So In order for you to have an idea of what I think about the things that Stephen Dynan says, let me just point out my dissertation just 3 years ago, that when I finished school, came out of a desire to understand what anti-Judaism is about anti-Semitism, because I had an intuition that that was connected with the validation of Christian supremacy. And Christian supremacy also militates against ethnic and sexual minorities. So the title of my dissertation was How the Process of Doctrinal Standardization During the Later Roman Empire Relates to Christian Triumphalism. All right? So if you know anything about, you know, like the church fathers and the church councils and that kind of thing, how did that become a product of empire? And because I think that we need to figure out ways to dismantle the complex political and cultural machine that really carries the face of being white and Christian. It's really Westernism. I'm not comfortable with the term, so comfortable with the term white supremacy as I am with Western supremacy. For one reason, because there are many people of color who find advantage in a system that oppresses other people of color, so it can't just totally be white supremacy. It's Western supremacy. It's Christian Western supremacy. Now, you might get the idea, am I saying that all of Westernism is counterproductive, destructive, oppressive, hateful? No. There are good things to be extracted from Westernism. The problem is the sense of supremacy and imperialism that it perpetuates among its proponents, its principles. And so here's something that I liked that Stephen Dynan said. To live and breathe, this is on page 64, to live and breathe as one global people, we need something akin to an African family reunion. One in which we honor the shared heritage of all races and peoples fully facing America's history around African enslavement is part of redeeming our relationship with African peoples, which goes beyond the paternalism of philanthropy to a stance of partnership and respect. African culture is our mother culture, quite literally, and we have not honored our mother. Okay. Then Dynan says this, the pathway to increased understanding requires social healing on a large scale. It involves listening to each other, being present to pain, and exploring ways to resolve negative memories and reveal hidden power dynamics. Okay, so I take exception a little bit to this. And the reason is that I spend more of my time among younger African Americans than older. Now, when I say that, that's not a lot of people because I live in Santa Barbara. So, obviously, I spend more time with Latinos than whites, generally speaking. However, Dynan says there has to be more listening to each other. And I would, if I would just pick randomly one of my colleagues who is 20 years old and African American, they would probably say, no, we don't need to listen to each other. We need to be listened to more. Dynan says, it's vital that we build bridges of understanding both to activist movements like Black Lives Matter that are seeking to end an end to racially biased police violence and to police officers on the other side who can feel compromised in their ability to protect people and perform a very hard job. Okay, so I thought that was a targeted and simplistic view of Black Lives Matter. From the website, Black Lives Matter, Who We Are, it goes beyond the narrow nationalism that can be prevalent within black communities, which merely call on black people to love black, live black, and buy black, keeping straight cis black men in the front of the movement, while our sisters, queers, and trans and disabled folk take up roles in the background or not at all. Black Lives Matter affirms the lives of black, queer, and trans folks, disabled folks, and black undocumented folks, folks with records, women, and all black lives along with the gender spectrum. It centers on those who have been marginalized within black liberation movements. It is a tactic to rebuild the movement. So what this tells me is that, among other things in the identity of Black Lives Matter, is that Black Lives Matter is actually the present relevant iteration of building our community. As much as it is ridiculed, lambasted, and dismissed, it carries a gravitas in this emerging generation that nobody else has. The NAACP doesn't have it. The Urban League doesn't have it. Why is that? It's because those still carry some of the traces of the Christian supremacy. And we're looking at the term they use to describe themselves as "we are woke." And it's part of the Christian supremacy includes the exclusion of sexual minorities. And so what they are saying is that if we're gonna be voices and advocates for people on the margins, then that's where we should start, not where we should end. We should start with the people who are excluded first and most. So this is what gives credibility in this emerging generation to Black Lives Matter. Not that it's about black people, but that it's about black people who didn't count even among black people. So I'm going to stop because my time is up. And we're going to have a break, right? Okay, so...